Good morning and welcome to a special edition of Midday here on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichen, and this morning we're broadcasting live from the Republican Party State Convention underway at the Mayo Civic Center in downtown Rochester. About 2,000 delegates from all around the state are here in Rochester to meet and greet, talk politics, talk issues, and most importantly, give their party's official endorsement to incumbent Republican Senator Rod Grams, who's running for re-election this fall. That's scheduled to occur tomorrow, the endorsement, and we'll be on the air with live coverage, so hope you can join us. Our coverage begins at 9 tomorrow morning. Today on Midday, we're going to kick off our coverage with two of the party's top elected officials, and two of the men being talked about as possible candidates for governor or perhaps the U.S. Senate 2 years from now, Tim Pawlenty and Norm Coleman. Over the noon hour, we'll be joined by our crack political analysts, Tom Horner and Sarah Stace, and we'll be taking your calls as well. So thanks for joining us. Settle back. We think you're going to enjoy the coverage. To get started this morning, Minnesota Public Radio's political editor Mike Mulcahy has joined us here at the broadcast table. Good morning, Mike.
Morning, Gary.
Seems like we were just here.
Yeah, it's great to be back, isn't it?
Prime location for the Republican convention here, right off the stage.
Well, you know, last week at the DFL convention, we were on the right side of the stage. This week we're on the left side of the stage, so I guess that means neither party trusts us very much.
Now, for the most part, fairly routine business this morning. We should note the convention actually began a couple hours ago.
Right. They've been talking about some of the rules and not quite the platform yet, but now they're hearing speeches from people who want to be elected as delegates to the national convention. They have to elect 10 delegates here and 10 alternates here. They've already elected 24 delegates, 24 alternates previous to the convention.
And then there was a nice little rules fight this morning?
Well, a little one over this whole issue of endorsing judges, whether the party should endorse judges. It's not even clear that that's legal yet. The Republicans have filed a lawsuit to make it clear that they can do that. Right now, judges run nonpartisan. And the Republicans say there's nothing that prevents them from endorsing candidates in races for judges. And there was just some concern this morning early on about the rules, how they would go at that process during the convention.
Real different feel here at the Republican convention than there was last week at the DFL. There was a real suspense, tension in the air last week. This is more of a celebration, I think.
Absolutely, and I think we'll see that tomorrow when Rod Grams is endorsed. The other difference, I guess, is that the Republicans listen much more carefully to what's going on up at the podium than the Democrats do. They're all sitting in rows, and it's just quiet out there on the floor.
Well, joining us to talk about the convention, some of the issues that are being discussed here, Minnesota State Representative Tim Pawlenty from Eagan, majority leader of the Minnesota House, co-chair of the convention, and one of the party's rising stars. In fact, there's a fair amount of talk that Representative Pawlenty could end up running for governor 2 years from now. Representative Pawlenty, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Gary. Pleasure to be here.
Are you thinking about running for governor?
Well, I would be less than honest if I told you I wasn't considering that, or perhaps the U.S. Senate vacancy in 2 years. But in the meantime, I've got a big job as House Majority Leader, and my main job I've got to stay focused on is getting our Republican majority reelected to the majority in this fall's election, and we got to have a successful 2001 session. So while I am interested, I am considering it, I'm not going to make any decisions along those lines until probably well into 2001.
In terms of the convention itself, beyond the pro forma endorsement of Senator Grams, what else are you hoping to accomplish here?
Well, I think you used the word celebration earlier. There's a lot I think the Republicans can celebrate. The accomplishments of the Republican majority in the Minnesota House, for example, the continued success of the Republicans nationally, Senator Graham's coronation, if you will, for re-election. Beyond that, there's going to be some skirmishes, but most of the stuff, the rules fight that Mike mentioned earlier, tends to be inside baseball and probably not newsworthy. The one exception to that might be the judicial endorsement issue, which probably will get some press.
Tell us about that a little bit. Who's on what side and why?
Well, it's a little unclear. There's been some skirmishes over this issue in the past within our party at conventions, and to date, anyhow, we've decided not to get into the business of endorsing judicial candidates. There does appear to be a contingent, I'm not sure how large it is, at this convention that feels very strongly about endorsing judicial candidates. There's going to be a report from a judicial nominating committee coming forward for the convention to consider, and that'll come up, and it's going to be controversial. But I suspect there's some momentum here for endorsing judicial candidates. On a personal level, I'm concerned by that. I'm troubled by that. I don't like to see the judiciary becoming politicized either way.
Is this partially abortion politics? Are we seeing people who would like to endorse candidates who oppose legal abortion?
Well, I suspect it has to do with frustration over activities by judges that perhaps delegates perceive as judicial activists not adhering to the constitutional principles specifically and taking too much latitude with statutes and laws, and so they want to have them more accountable. Problem is, once you open this door, of course, it may swing over time the other way. And when you practice law, there's supposed to be a legally correct outcome. It's not a popularity contest. You could have somebody who commits a very heinous criminal offense, and it would be horribly unpopular to perhaps have to make a ruling saying that the police or whoever didn't follow the proper procedures, and yet that may be the legally correct thing to do. And if you go to states like Michigan and Texas and you look at how their judicial process has become politicized, with raising money, making declarations on issues, blatant partisan campaigning, that makes me feel uncomfortable.
I think it's fair to say that for the most part, delegates here are all on the same page, fairly unified. But then there was this, in terms of some party division and so on, there was the problem that arose at the end of the legislative session when top contributor Michael Wigley said he'd had it. He'd had it with you people. You weren't delivering the tax cuts that you were supposed to. How deep is that rift? I mean, how many people in this room, for example, are upset over the fact that you didn't take a tougher line on holding out for big, big tax cuts?
Well, Gary, I think there's some disappointment. I don't think it's a majority. I think most people are probably reasonably satisfied with what we did. But clearly there is a faction within the base of the Republican Party that feels that the Republican House majority didn't go far enough fast enough. And we try to put it in context for them and say, look, we passed the largest tax cuts in Minnesota history, the largest in the nation in gross terms and per capita terms. We cut the size of the bonding bill in half. We slowed down the rate of growth of state spending. That's not a bad 18 months work. And, when you're talking about change in a democracy, oftentimes it's incremental. We are moving in the right direction. It maybe wasn't a touchdown this past session, but it was a field goal. And so folks here, I think, who are activists are very committed, very passionate, and it's frustrating and disappointing after 20 or 30 years of democratic rule in Minnesota to not be able to change everything overnight. And when you have mixed government, that's perhaps a little unrealistic.
Are they going to sit on their hands this fall, or maybe more importantly, sit on their wallets this fall?
Well, we hope over the course of the next 3-4 months, for those who are perhaps disappointed, we're going to have a chance to visit with them to hopefully put these our successes in context, show them that we are headed in the right direction, we can get them back on board before November.
And you really have a razor-thin margin in the House right now. What do you think the prospects are for expanding that or for keeping control of the House this fall?
Well, I think pretty good. The reality, though, is we're running on a DFL redistricting plan. The DFL passed a redistricting plan in the early 90s. Governor Carlson botched the vetoes, and so we ran and took the Republican majority on a DFL redistricting plan, and that was never supposed to happen. So we have a razor-thin majority, as you said. We do have some open seats we're going to have to protect. But if you look at the environment that we're in right now, the people, I think, are fairly satisfied with the work of the legislature. I think they're fairly satisfied with the work of the Republican House. We've done a good deal of reform, a good deal of balance, and I don't sense that there is a big overwhelming sentiment to throw us out. In fact, if you look at our messages and Governor Bush's messages that are going to be predominant in the presidential race and the messages that are going to be predominant in the Senate race in Minnesota, I think they're going to play well for us.
And that's a big question, right? I mean, who's at the top of the ticket? You have George W. Bush. Rod Graham's in the polls has been, I don't think he's reached 50% in terms of approval. Does that concern you?
Well, Rod Graham's in a vacuum. His numbers perhaps haven't been the greatest, but you got to remember those numbers tend to change when you actually insert a real person in the opposition column, and you have to say, well, it's not Rod Graham's versus my ideal version of who the candidate might be. Now it's Rod Graham's versus Mark Dayton. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden people may not be so hot about Mark Dayton, and Rod's numbers may change as a result of that. But, this George W. Bush phenomena or campaign is going to be very significant because on the issue of Social Security, this could be a potentially profound realigning campaign for national politics. know, the Democrats have made a living out of scaring seniors as a way to get elected and maintain their position. If a Republican candidate can talk about meaningful Social Security reform and survive and win and take that card away from the Democrats of scaring seniors, this is going to be a profound election in terms of national politics being realigned, and that's going to trickle down to Minnesota as well.
And again, sort of on the horse race, when you look at the polls with George Bush and Al Gore, Bush seems to be doing fairly well here. I mean, Democrats do well in Minnesota when they run for president, but at least this year, they're neck and neck.
I think he does, and I think there's a number of reasons for that. You know, Vice President Gore's a little stiff as a candidate. I think it takes a bit to warm up to him. I think, frankly, Governor Bush is a little more personal, a little more dynamic, probably a little more visionary. And then beyond that, Governor Bush is a Republican who's an empowerment Republican. He talks about compassionate conservative. He doesn't just hammer on the traditional kind of Republican themes. He talks about reaching out to communities of color. He talks about reaching out to disenfranchised individuals. And if you look at the way the demographics of this country are going, if, as Republicans, we aren't able to grow this party, particularly as it relates to groups that are not now Republicans, people of lower socioeconomic means, suburban women, or women particularly, or generally, also people who are in communities of color. But that is a formula that we need to advance if we're going to be a majority party in this country, in this state, and Governor Bush is having some success doing that.
If you're just tuning in, we're broadcasting live today from the Republican Party State Convention underway at the Mayo Civic Center in downtown Rochester. I'm Gary Eichten, Minnesota Public Media's political editor. Mike Mulcahy has joined us. And our guest this first half hour, State Representative Tim Pawlenty, who is the majority leader of the Minnesota House, could end up as a statewide candidate 2 years from now. He's co-chairing the convention, and he's come by today to talk about Republican Party issues. You mentioned Social Security. It seems like there is the possibility, at least, the theoretical possibility of a significant debate, not only at the national level, but the state level, and a whole variety of really key issues, Social Security, health care, national defense at the presidential level. The question is whether or not we will actually have that debate. Do you suspect that will play out, or are we going to end up looking at a series of 30-second attack ads saying how awful the other guy is?
Well, it tends to boil down to the latter, and I hope that we can avoid that. But, you know, if you look at the issues that are before us, as a Republican, if we just have a race for who's willing to spend more on the infrastructure of government, in health care, and in education, and various programs that we have, Republicans aren't going to win that debate. And so it's no coincidence that when Bush and McCain ran against each other, they were both desperate to grab the reform mantle. Because Republicans, as a group, aren't going to outspend Democrats, and the measure of our success can't be how much money we're going to spend. So we have to have a reform agenda. And if Governor Bush can lead the way and Senator Graham can lead the way by starting with reforming Social Security, and we can move that debate into reforming education, not just how much we're going to spend on it, but reforming it, on reforming elder care, on reforming government, on reforming taxes, those are our themes. And people respond very well to that. They know it's not just about throwing more money at it. They want to know, can you make it better? Can you improve it for the same amount of money or less?
When push comes to the shove, though, out in the campaign hustings this fall, isn't it likely that your message is going to end up being tax cuts, tax cuts, tax cuts, and, oh, by the way, tax cuts?
Well, that is our marquee issue. There's no question about that, and for good reason. You know, people kind of say we're obsessed with tax cuts, but it's not just about tax cuts in a vacuum. It's about jobs. It's about a business environment where people can stay in Minnesota, be entrepreneurs, grow their businesses, bring their businesses here, and provide jobs. And this is a serious debate, because you look at the LTV mining company in northern Minnesota leaving, you look at ReliaStar being bought out, you look at Honeywell being bought out, you look at the potential for Northwest Airlines being bought out, you look at the rumors on the street about the future of U.S. Bank and many others. The last Fortune 500 company that was founded in Minnesota, other than Best Buy, which is a retailer, was Medtronic 45 years ago. This is an issue that if we don't address and get ahead of, we're going to wake up 15 or 20 years ago and wonder what happened to this great state.
This summer, the rebate checks will go out, and dollars to donuts, they'll be referred to as Jesse's rebate again. Do you find that pretty frustrating?
Well, it is frustrating. Any governor has the bully pulpit, you know, whether it's Governor Carlson or Governor Perpich, just because of the nature of the governorship, the press gives them disproportionate attention, and perhaps justifiably so. But not only does this governor has the usual bully pulpit of a governor, he's got the turbocharged bully pulpit of a governor who's also an international celebrity. And he has a press conference, and the room is jam-packed. And if we have a press conference, we're lucky if the Minnesota Daily shows up. So it's not fair, but it is frustrating. We work our tail off. Governor Ventura, by and large, is not a tax cutter. His cut proposals over the last two sessions have been meager compared to ours, but yet he gets a lot of the credit for it. It's not fair, but, that's life.
But he's wildly popular. What does that tell you? I mean, what does it tell you? What should it tell Democrats? As you go down your separate paths, he stands there kind of in the middle of things, and his approval ratings are going through the roof.
Well, I think, first of all, his numbers have wavered a bit, particularly in the suburbs. If you look at the governor's numbers in the suburban areas, metropolitan areas, they are not what they used to be. And ironically, even though he's been fairly cold towards greater Minnesota, his numbers disproportionately are good in greater Minnesota and in the Anoka County area. But I think what it tells me is that times are good. We're not in crisis. People perceive themselves as being or are indeed content. They think the governor's funny. They think he's entertaining. He has successfully fused politics and entertainment and news in a way that I think is probably not healthy for our system, but it is the era that we live in. And my hope is that people will start looking at the governor more critically, and I think they're going to cut him a lot less slack if we have a few more significant bumps in the road. I mean, if he is AWOL, I shouldn't say that because he gets mad when I use military terms, but if he's not around and Northwest emerges and we have a couple of more blips here, his numbers could turn fairly quickly. And So we are frustrated.
Are you surprised at how much you've had to fight him? I mean, it seemed like last session it was always the Democrats in the Senate and the governor against the House.
Yeah, it is frustrating because when he ran in 1998, if you set aside the social issues, you would have thought he was not only an economic conservative but a bordering on a libertarian. And now that he's become governor, his governing doesn't match up to his rhetoric. And so we thought we were going to have an ally in the economic cluster of issues. We don't. So that is disappointing. And we're not just sit by. We want to hold him accountable for his actions or lack of actions, and unlike Roger Moe, we call it as we see it with respect to the governor.
I need to ask you about the party process a little bit. Political parties, have they become nothing more really than just conduits for money? Collect money and send it off to...
Is that a leading question, Gary?
Well, I'm just...
Actually, if you look around the room here at this convention or at the grassroots level, these are not the political party organization. At the grassroots level, it's not about money. It is about activists and people who have deep passion about issues and causes. And it really gets into the donor community, I think is what you're talking about, and the effect that has on parties. There's a recent court ruling in Minnesota that's going to allow parties and party caucuses to make so-called independent expenditures on behalf of their candidates. That level of soft money coming to a party or caucus is going to accelerate wildly in this next election cycle. And to some extent, they have become... laundering operations is probably not a very good term, but parties collect large sums of money from lots of folks and interest groups and the like and turn around and spend it to get their people elected.
Should that be changed?
Well, I must say in Minnesota's defense, in 1993 we passed landmark campaign finance reform in Minnesota. It was called then, and I think still is now, probably the most significant campaign finance reform in the country. We have severe limits on what a candidate can take from PACs and lobbyists. And other interest groups, that those limitations, however, don't extend to parties. You got to be careful about this, though, because we're talking about First Amendment rights and political speech, and if you are a free market person in business and politics, you don't want to be drawing lines on people's ability through whatever means they have to engage in political speech.
There's a theory that says that because there is so much money in politics, that's why a lot of people are uninterested in politics, turned off by it. Do you think that's true?
I don't think it's so much the money. I think it's more that people have a feeling that government is becoming irrelevant to them. That, if you're somebody in my district and you're both working, you and your spouse are working, you got to get your kids for soccer, you got to get them to school in the morning, unless government really does something stupid and torques you off, my constituents who are fortunate in many respects say, look, I need my schools funded, I need good schools, I need good roads, I want my taxes, moderate or low, and I like nice parks, otherwise get out of my face. That's kind of their view of government in a nutshell. And so it has to be relevant. And I don't think that much of what we do as political parties or even as legislators is viewed as being impactful or relevant to people's lives.
Is that something that should, is that something that those of you in public life should change, or is that just a fact of life these days?
I think it the McCain phenomena, even though I'm a Bush supporter and don't agree all with everything McCain says, the McCain phenomena, and to some extent the Ventura phenomenon, is very instructive. People are so cynical about politicians and the process, they don't believe that you're going to deliver on what you're saying. And John McCain spoke bluntly, as did Governor Ventura as a candidate, from his gut. There was a sense that this was just not another, mealy-mouthed, BSing politician. This was somebody who was speaking from his gut, was going to deliver the real goods, was the real deal. And there was a core nerve, I think, that both McCain and Ventura, at least as a candidate, struck. And there's a lesson for that in the rest of us. Quit acting like a politician, speak from the heart, speak from the gut, and deliver on what you say.
Do you think that the two major parties will kind of co-opt that feeling now, or do you see the Independence Party this year as a major factor in either the U.S. Senate race or in the legislative races?
I don't see the Independence Party as a major factor. I think they're going to play the role of potentially a spoiler. I think there's no legislative race where the Independence or Reform Party will win, but they're going to get 5, 10, 15% of the vote, and depending on which party they take the vote from, they could dictate the outcome and the majority of the Minnesota legislature. But in terms of the parties, I don't think the parties, because they are a reflection of the activists and the passion of the grassroots activists, are well positioned to tap into what I would call kind of that independent-minded person who views governments largely irrelevant, and unless you really make them mad, they don't get very motivated about politics. So we need candidates who can present, in our case, the Republican message as a relevant message that speaks to people's lives in real terms, but also projects that we're not just being the usual politician, that we're talking boldly, that we're talking truthfully, that we're going to deliver, and being a little Minnesotans like mavericks. And you look at Perpich, you look at Wellstone, you look at Ventura, you go back in our populist history of this state, Minnesotans like a little maverick and their politician. And if you just go lockstep all the time with whatever the platform or the party position is, you lose some of that maverick quality.
I want to go back to the business about the House leadership before we wrap up here. Is there going to be any effort to replace House Speaker Steve Sligo?
There's been a call for his resignation by some of the large individual donors, but that is not an imminent turn of events. I don't think the votes are there to take out Speaker Swigum, and nor should he be taken out. He's done a good job. Every year that he's been there, he's increased the majority of the Minnesota House. It's a delicate balance when you have the range of thought and philosophy in our caucus that you have. Trying to herd 70 cats is a tough job, and he's done a good job.
Now, as you weigh your future here, what factors are you going to be thinking about to run or not to run for a higher office?
Well, and Norm just arrived here, so I'm taking some lessons from Tanya Harding. You remember that incident with I jest. No, I'm going to just stay focused on being majority leader, and then I don't have any grand strategy or plans. I'm just going to try to get through keeping us in the majority this session or this election, and then having a successful 2001 session, and then depending on what my friend Norm does, I'll have to go out to dinner with him and talk to him and see what his plans are. I haven't had a chance to do that.
We'll grill him in just a second here.
Yeah, you do that.
Thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, my pleasure, Kay.
Good speaking with you. State Representative Tim Pawlenty from Eagan, who is the majority leader of the Minnesota House, one of the party's rising stars. He is co-chair of the Republican Party State Convention underway here at the Civic Center in downtown Rochester. Mike Mulcahy is with me. I'm Gary Eichten, and midday coming to you today from the convention. We have more coverage through the afternoon, and live coverage of the endorsement process begins at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning here on Minnesota Public Radio. So stay tuned all weekend long. Should be some interesting discussion, conversation, and maybe, Mike, we'll even have some fun along the way.
Let's hope so. It's been fun so far.
We'll continue with our conversation in just a couple of minutes.
Today's programming is made possible in part by the advocates of Minnesota Public Radio. Contributors include the Southways Foundation and the Tennant Company, helping customers create a cleaner and safer world.
This week, a Prairie Home Companion comes to you from the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul. with New Orleans jazz vocalist Bonnie Gibson and her band. Lynn Peterson, the Guys All-Star Shoe Band, the news from Lake Wobegon coming up this week.
Listen for Prairie Home Companion Saturday afternoon at 5 on all NPR stations, and again Sunday at noon on Minnesota Public Radio, KNOW-FM 91.1 in the Twin Cities.
Political analyst Tom Horner and Sarah Stace coming up over the noon hour. We'll be talking with St. Paul Mayor Norm Coleman in just a moment. But right now, let's catch up on news headlines. Here's William Wilcox. William?
Thanks, Gary. In the news, the House has started work toward a vote that Republicans hope will bury the estate tax. GOP lawmakers label it the death tax. They say it hurts small family farms and businesses that must be sold in order to pay the estate taxes. But Democrats say the measure will only benefit the wealthiest Americans. President Clinton has promised to veto the GOP plan, saying it's too expensive. The FBI meets with computer security experts today to discuss another cyber bug that's lurking on thousands of personal computers. Experts at Network Security Technologies say they've discovered a malicious program disguised as a movie clip that could be used by hackers to shut down internet websites. The experts say home computer users who use high-speed connections to surf the World Wide Web are especially vulnerable to being attacked. The departing commander of an army base in Kentucky insists there has not been a climate of homophobia during his tenure. A gay private was beaten to death by another soldier at Fort Campbell last July. Commander Robert Clark is denying he tolerated any anti-gay harassment among his soldiers or did little to prevent it. Clark is leaving after nearly 2.5 years in charge. Stocks have been higher on Wall Street today after the latest government report on the economy. It showed mild inflation, giving investors even more evidence that those interest rate hikes are finally helping to slow the economy. Governor Jesse Ventura says he'll push for legislators to meet in session every other year as he continues his campaign for a unicameral legislature. The legislature did meet every other year until the 1973-74 session, when lawmakers decided to start meeting annually to pass a budget 1 year and handle borrowing for capital projects in the next year. It'll be hot and windy over most of Minnesota today with highs in the 90s. Cooler in the North Country, where there's also a chance of thunderstorms. There is a wind advisory in effect for southwestern Minnesota. Currently in the Twin Cities with sunny skies, the temperature 80 degrees. And that's the latest news from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm William Wilcoxon.
Thanks, William. 27 minutes now before noon. This is Midday, coming to you live from the Republican Party State Convention underway in Rochester. We're at the Mayo Civic Center, and about 2,000 delegates have gathered here to conduct party business. Tomorrow, the big item on the agenda, the formal endorsement of incumbent Republican Senator Rod Grams for another term in the Senate. Of course, he's up for re-election this fall. That will be coming up tomorrow. We'll have live coverage here on Minnesota Public Radio. This hour, we're talking now with St. Paul Mayor Norm Coleman, who is the chair of the George W. Bush campaign here in the state of Minnesota. Of course, Mayor Coleman ran for governor on the Republican Party ticket 2 years ago, finishing a close second behind Jesse Ventura. And Mayor Coleman said this week that he may take another run at governor 2 years from now. Minnesota Public Radio's political editor Mike Mulcahy has joined us as we grill Mayor Coleman.
Isn't it nice being at a convention where there's kind of a minimum of infighting? Folks are focused on getting things done. That's what the American public, Minnesota, they want. Politicians to get things done. At this convention, we're going to endorse Rod Grams by acclamation. We're going to move forward with an effort to make sure that George W. Bush is the next president of the United States, and I believe we have a very good chance of winning Minnesota, which hasn't happened. Minnesota hasn't been in the R column since 1972, so you've got folks here pretty unified. It's a very nice feel for a political event.
Well, you're speaking to the convention this afternoon, and I guess you're going to be talking about the Bush campaign. What are you going to tell the delegates?
I will tell the delegates that this is an important election, that George W. Bush is. It's interesting because you've got a guy who actually has better experience to be the president than a two-term vice president and a two-term United States senator. Because George Bush has governed, and he has cut taxes, he has supported education, he has been a proven leader, and so you've got somebody out there who's done it, and I think we'll have the confidence of the American people running against somebody who I don't think has that confidence. The other issue, which is fascinating, is Bush is out there, George W. Bush is out there proposing things on education, on Social Security, on national defense, and it is the vice president who is reacting to, well, this is too risky, we shouldn't do that. You got George W. Bush is the person out there with ideas. So I think it'll be an interesting race. We have a shot to win in Minnesota, and in part because I believe Minnesotans reflect the compassionate conservatism that George Bush is all about.
Is he up for the job, though?
I have some question about that, or at least... Well, there's a question on the other side. There's always question. This is the guy who has governed. This is the guy that has produced results. And this is the guy that is out there. You look at the debate today. Look at the debate today. Who's out there proposing initiatives on national defense, on Social Security, on education, on taxes? And you've got the vice president, rather than proposing his agenda, is talking about this is too risky and we can't change this and we can't do that. I think he's clearly shown that he's up to the job. He has governed. He has demonstrated the ability to lead. And I think the people in this state will see that.
But, Mayor, aren't times in this country pretty good right now? Couldn't you argue why switch horses now when the last 8 years have been pretty good?
And that is what makes it difficult. Clearly, when you've got an incumbent and times are good, I think, Mike, the difference here, two things. One, the whole issue of trust and character is out there. And if anything, the vice president is having problems now on some of the fundraising issues, FBI coming back and saying the vice president knew about doing things that were not legal. You got the sitting vice president saying as a defense, there is no controlling legal authority for me doing things that we now know to be inappropriate. I think that people feel good about the Clinton era, but what's going on? I would argue the Republican Congress and Alan Greenspan had a lot to do with that. But I think if you ask him, do you want to go forward with the character issue, the trust issue, I think that's what makes this race different. I think many of us are still recoiling from the fact that we had to turn off the 6 o'clock news or shut off public radio because we didn't want our kids to listen to discussion about the vice president and, the president's sexual activities. So I think that's the difference. Good times usually bode well for the incumbent. On the other hand, I think people are saying, hey, we like the good times. We don't want to continue with the trust and character problems that we've had already.
Now, what's ahead for Norm Coleman? You talked a little bit this week about, once again...
Gondolas running over the Mississippi River, maybe streetcars on Grand Avenue, better times for St. Paul. I think a lot of good things ahead for Norm Coleman. Hockey NHL Arena opens up. October 11th is the first official game. I think there's an exhibition on the 29th of September. I've done a lot of ribbon cuttings.
We were thinking a little farther
beyond that.
Statewide. You talked this week about possibly running for governor again. Are you also thinking about running for the Senate?
Well, I have to smile a little bit. What I said is let's postpone that discussion until after November. Gary, I love to serve. I really believe that I do a good job representing St. Paul families, and I believe I could have done a good job representing Minnesota families. I think the lot of families in St. Paul today is better than it was when I took office. There's more jobs, there's less crime, there's more vitality, there's a greater sense of hope and optimism, more choices in education with an expansion of charter schools. I believe we've done a lot of good things in St. Paul, and I love being involved in that. I love to serve families. That's what I do. That's, I think, my calling. I would love to do it on a state level. I believe I could have been a great governor, at least a good governor, and came close. But you know, second place doesn't get you anything. You don't govern with second place in this business. And so that's never left. I mean, I'm proud of public service. I'm proud of a desire to serve the people of Minnesota. What I have to do, though, is hold off that discussion until we get done with what's in front of us, which is the election of George W. Bush, which is the reelection of Senator Rod Grams, which is the reelection of a Republican majority in the House. So those are the things I got in front of me. I want to get those done. But I have never hid a desire to serve, and I think that's a good thing. I think it's a good thing. My family would like me to make more money. I love serving St. Paul families. I believe I've done a good job, and I would love to have that chance to do that in Minnesota. But I gotta wait. And a day in this business is like a month in another business. You gotta wait. So let's get through November. I want to hold off any of the speculation and then go from there.
I want to clarify, though. I was surprised to hear that at least you were open to the possibility of running for the Senate. Now, because before you said you just had no interest.
Well,
in that.
I have to. I believe I serve as a chief executive. That's what I like to do. And if I run for statewide office again, I would intend to run for governor. That's what I would intend to do. And I got big, and I want to wait before making that. Let's hold off that discussion. What I did is I said, I'm not ruling anything out. I'm not saying it. In other words, it was the lack of saying something. I didn't preclude anything. But I believe I have experience as a good chief executive of the capital city. I would have loved to have the opportunity to do that state level. I gave it my best shot, came up short. I will have. Let's wait until after November to see where we go. So that's my focus. But what I said is, I'm not ruling anything out, but I'm not ruling anything in. And, of course, when you say that in my business, then speculation, well, you're going to run for senator, you want to be in the cabinet, you want to be vice president. No, I'm having a great time being mayor. There's more to be done. Let's get through November and see where we go.
Tax cuts, tax cuts, tax cuts, more tax cuts. Is that enough for Republicans to run on in Minnesota?
No. You've got to clearly go beyond. I ran on tax. In fact, we won. I tell people we won on the issues. We won on the issue. I mean, and my last, the race for governor, in the end, I think it was more about attitude than it was about issues. I convinced people that I would have cut taxes, and I think it was a fair skip. I'd have raised them, but that's not enough. You've got to touch people. And although education is a critical issue, expanding choice, giving parents the opportunity to be more involved in their kids' education, charter schools, both at, by the way, at the national level, George W. Bush understands this at the local level. Issues of public safety are still important to people, and just overall, I think kind of lifting up the spirit. You got to go beyond the single issue, and I think this party is more than capable of doing that. We're very good at cutting taxes. We're very good at saying let parents make choices rather than the government make choices for them. Let's cut taxes permanently so we don't keep having surpluses and having more government programs. We can't be anti-government. We can't be anti. We got to be for good government, for fiscally prudent government, for responsible government. Competition, I believe, is a good thing. Let government serve people better. But if it's just about taxes, it's not enough. We've got to go beyond that.
How do you think Jesse Ventura has been doing?
I think Jesse has, I started out by applauding Jesse for some of his cabinet choices. They're very, very good people. But I don't think, I'm going to say that, I don't think Jesse has provided a vision for Minnesota. Where are we going? Other than his vision, you know, what he wants, personally. And I don't think he has put the effort into governing. I'm going to be very blunt. Not being there the last 2 days and being in Washington. You got to work at this business. You got to work with people, even those that you may argue with the next day or the day before. You got to work with them. So I think Jesse has certainly brought a lot of high profile, but in the end, I think there's been a lack of vision. Where are we going as a state? And then not the willingness to put in the hard work that has to be done. If you're going to lead people, you got to be willing to work hard. You got to be there. You got to show them you're out of your tent. And I think those are two great failings of this governor.
One of the things we hear frequently from the governor is that he really does represent the broad middle of Minnesota residents, that the Republicans are way to the right, Democrats way to the left, but the vast majority of people, according to the governor, are right where he is, right in the middle.
Gary, do you really believe the vast majority of people, the biggest issue for them is the cost of license plate tabs or a lower fee for personal watercraft? I think that's as much political rhetoric as anybody gives you. It's not about the fact is that both parties, on occasion, I will say the both parties, Democratic Party, they get stuck to the left, and our party in the past has had the trouble with the right. But I think there's a lot of rhetoric. Ultimately, I believe my party. I believe the Republican Party represents the vast majority of Minnesotans. That's why we won the House last time. I think the vast majority of Minnesotans want compassion to conservatism. They want to be fiscally responsible. They want to keep lids on taxes. They want more economic freedom. But they want compassion. They want to make sure. But wealth, expanding welfare isn't compassion. Reforming welfare was compassionate. Being tough and vigorous on crime and drugs and gangs and the little things, truancy, graffiti, that's compassionate. So I think our party represents the broad middle, the compassionate conservative sense of who Minnesotans are. So I think what you're getting from the governor, what does that mean? What does that really mean? In the end, Minnesotans, I believe, offer the things that my party, George W. Bush, certainly is articulating. And then down the line, the Rod Grahams, the folks running for Congress, the folks running for state and local office.
What's the difference? You've been on both sides of the fence. You were a Democrat and then...
Much more orderly conventions, Republican conventions, much less strife. If there's a fundamental difference, my kid asked me this question the other day, my daughter. She's getting into politics. Same one who gave me the political advice I should have heeded about, Daddy, show people your heart and you'd win. She asked me, what's the difference between Democrat and Republican? And, 10-year-old, what does that mean? I think fundamentally it means that Democrats, I believe, have a greater belief in government solving our problems. And so if there's a choice between something being done free enterprise, private side, Democrats would say, let's create a program. I think Republicans believe that if you unleash the great human potential in all of us, regardless of race, religion, creed, regardless of economic status, that we can have a better America. So that what government does, and I believe, is we shape an environment in which people grow jobs, in which they choose to raise their families here. We give parents more choices about their kids' education rather than having a federal program decide this is what it is. So I think it's a fundamental different view of government. Democrats, by nature, believe in greater, more government. Republicans, you've got to still believe in government, but I think they believe in ultimately government-shaping environment that unleashes the human spirit, the human imagination, the human heart.
Is abortion still the great fault line in Minnesota politics?
It certainly is. It continues to be a fault line. It continues to be a fault line, clearly. And listen, I was, and I am pro-life, unabashed about that. Doesn't impact what I do as mayor. But Gary, I believe that had I been pro-choice, I might have been endorsed in a DFL convention many years ago. I think that was just a dividing line right there, no matter what. Then I got into trouble with AFSCME over rejecting a contract because of retiree health benefits. I got with the MEA over school choice. So I made a lot of, I lost a lot of friends in the DFL over the years, for what I believe. But the fundamentals, that's still a fault line. Yeah, it is, and it's there. On the other hand, you've got to reach beyond that issue. You've got to work with people, certainly in my party, you've got to work with people who are pro-choice, who have a different perspective. And people can agree with you 70% of the time, and that's okay. You can't expect everyone to agree with you 100% of the time.
I think that's such an important issue, not at the mayoral level necessarily, but at the statewide level, national level. Is that one of those issues that is so fundamental that voters ought to say, well, okay, first of all, you have to pass that test, then we can look at you?
I think it's certainly an important issue, and for a group of folks on both sides of the equation, those who are passionately pro-life and those who are passionately pro-choice, there is a larger issue there about respect for life, and that's an important issue. And that's I think that has some impact, respect for family and those things in the end. You know, we have kids who don't go shoot other kids. I mean, there's a fundamental disrespect for life in society today, and how do you approach that is one of the great conundrums, one of the great dilemmas Democrats and Republicans have to deal with. But I don't think it's the dominating issue. I mean, I am who I am, and I don't shy away from that. On the other hand, to govern, I don't spend 30 seconds on that issue. And if I was governed, I wouldn't spend a lot of time on the issue, but you'd know where I stood. And what I got to convince is, so for those people who support me, God bless. For those who don't, I would say you disagree with me on that issue. But on the other hand, if you want someone who has governed, you want someone who has cut taxes, has created an environment which has job growth, has brought new hope, new opportunity, then support me. Even if you don't agree with me on that issue, that issue itself cannot be the sole reason by which you choose to support or not support somebody.
You drew a lot of attention when you switched parties a couple of years back, but the last couple switches we've seen have been the other way. Judy Dutcher went from being a Republican to being a Democrat. Dean Johnson, state senator. What does that say about
the bouncing ball of politics, Mike? That's what it is. You know, nationally, there have been, I don't know, 500 party switches at least since Clinton took office. The overwhelming majority, probably 90-something percent, people going from Democrat to Republican. You know, in the end, in this business, you gotta know where your heart's at, and you gotta be comfortable with that, and say, here's who I am. I got elected in 1993. I ran against the endorsed candidate of the Democratic Party. So I wasn't, you know, embraced in the bosom of the party when I first got elected, and then fought battles with AFSCME, fought battles with the MEA, fought battles on the life, et cetera, et cetera. You know, for Judy Dutcher, and I work with Judy, I mean, her heart, she was a Democrat. That's what she believes. So be who you are, and then say it, and then move on. Without, you know, I'm not pointing a finger at the Democratic Party. I disagree with them on a lot of issues. I just think they're wrong. I think I ran against a great public servant, Skip Humphrey, a great public servant. We had a different vision. I think Skip honestly believed in more government and more programs, which in the end, to me, meant higher taxes, which meant less freedom for moms and dads to make choices they should make. We have some philosophical disagreements. That's okay. In this business, by the way, to get something done, I'll get back to a failing of the governor, you got to work with Democrats, you got to work with Republicans. You know, you got to compromise on occasion in order for government to do the business of the people, which means getting things done and not getting caught in extreme positions and not being immobile. The public expects politicians to work for them and to get things done.
Talk about the Senate race. The common wisdom is that Democrats have managed to shoot themselves in the foot here by having so many candidates still in the race. They've got a big primary election coming up. And they're going to have to spend a lot of money and on and on and on, while Senator Grahams will be able to sit back. But you were in a similar circumstance 2 years ago.
I would urge Gary, you're making here.
And I'm wondering if that's such an advantage. It seemed to me you fell right off the radar screen 2 years ago.
I made a tactical error. in sitting back, believing, Gary, we believe that the Democrats, that Mondale, Freeman, Dayton, Humphrey would beat each other up, would fight each other, and that I would kind of deal with the survivor and then spend, you know, have that two-month campaign. I spent my time traveling around Minnesota quite. I mean, I was in greater Minnesota consistently. On the other hand, what happened is that they chose to attack Norm Coleman. So Ted Mondale ran ads against Norm Coleman, and Mike Freeman ran ads against Norm Coleman, and Mark Dayton ran ads against Norm Coleman. And in the end, I was fighting all of them without a forum to fight back until the very end. So I think it would be mistaken strategy to think that because there are a lot of candidates, Democrats out there, that somehow that's going to be to Rod's advantage. Rod Grams will win because he has been a consistent voice for Minnesota families. He has been the champion of the $500 per child tax credit for families. He has been there, I got to tell you, as a mayor, been there on unfunded mandates, maybe not a big public issue, but an important one for the vitality of our cities. Been there for Social Security, including, by the way, as George Bush is, and has talked about a plan that would provide for the long-term viability of Social Security, which the Democrats and Al Gore tax is risky. I think it's bold and visionary. So Rod Grams has to win because of what he's about and what he's done, and you can't depend on the Democrats to eat themselves up. That was a mistake that we made, and I would urge the Graham folk not to make that same mistake.
How can he keep his name in the headlines?
It's a challenge. It really is a challenge. I mean, I stepped out of those debates, and certainly he's not going to be debating five Democrats, but I think he has to understand that he can't simply sit back and let the Democrats fight amongst themselves. They may well just decide to focus on him. Now, I will tell you, if I was a Democratic strategist for any of the candidates other than Humphrey in that last race, I probably would have gone after the front runner, and they didn't. And as a result, when we challenged Skip, in the end, we did well. It wasn't enough to win because something else happened. But I don't know. Rod's challenge is just, Rod has quietly been doing the job. If there's a fault, and I hear it as a Republican, I've said this to Rod, Rod's fault is that he hasn't spent 6 years promoting himself. He's just spent 6 years doing his job. That's what he does. He hasn't spent 6 years raising money, which a lot of politicians do. Now, that puts yourself at a disadvantage when you're in the election cycle. On the other hand, I believe he represents what Minnesota is all about, and he needs to work very hard to project that because he hasn't done it consistently for 6 years.
Last question before we wrap up. If you run for governor or anybody runs, somebody's going to run.
Somebody obviously. Will run. That I can predict.
Let's assume, how in the world can anybody follow Governor Ventura?
Well, I think the answer to that, I got to watch, maybe rather easily in terms of all actually governing, not so easy in terms of getting the attention and the prejudice. This may be the time of the politics of celebrity, and Jesse, the governor, is a celebrity. But in terms, I would hope that in a couple more years, people are hungry for good governance, hungry for somebody attending to their business and serving them. And if they are that hungry, then Norm Coleman would have a shot. And if they want something else, Gary, then we may be in a different wavelength, even different dimension in politics today. I don't know, but all I know, I'll keep doing what I do, which I think is right. And if people want me to serve, I love to serve, and I get a thrill. It's, I think, what God put me on this earth. I'm actually proud of that.
Thanks, Mayor. Appreciate your coming
Thank
by.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank
St. Paul Mayor Norm Coleman, who is the chair of the George W. Bush campaign here in the state of Minnesota. Mike, thanks for joining us this first hour of midday.
You bet, Gary.
We have much, much more coming up. We're going to take a short break, and then over the noon hour, we'll have a report on the Rod Grams campaign, and then we'll be talking with political analysts Tom Horner and Sarah Stace. We'll be opening the phone lines for your questions. A reminder that this afternoon, several speeches here at the convention, legislative leaders Steve Swigum and Dick Day will be speaking, Mayor Coleman will be speaking, and you can hear live coverage of those addresses on our website, mpr.org.
I'm Bob Edwards, host of NPR's Morning Edition. Join Carl Castle and me at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, June 29th at 7 o'clock to celebrate 20 amazing years of Morning Edition. We've got a lot of memories to share with you. Pick up free tickets at the Mississippi Markets in St. Paul and at the Seward Co-op or Linden Hills Co-op in Minneapolis. We'll see you there.
Is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 9th of June, 2000. It's the birthday of mystery writer Patricia Cornwell, born in Miami, 1956, who wrote three novels featuring male detectives. They were rejected, and then created a female character, Dr. Kay Scarpetta, a medical examiner who tracks down deranged killers based on their manner of mangling their victims. Her first Kay Scarpetta book was Postmortem in 1990, followed by Cruel and Unusual and Cause of Death. It's the birthday of Les Paul, the guitarist and inventor, born Lester William Paulsfuss in Waukesha, Wisconsin, 1915. He took a phonograph needle and used it to amplify his acoustic guitar, wired it up to a radio speaker. He later devised the first solid body electric guitar and introduced such recording innovations as overdubbing, the close mic technique, the record delay echo, and many other tricks now taken for granted in recording studios. It's the birthday of cartoonist George Price, born in Coitsville, New Jersey, 1901, who drew over 1,200 cartoons for The New Yorker magazine, drawings in which you often saw dangling, bare light bulbs and scrawny pets scratching away at themselves back in the corner. It's the birthday of playwright S.N. Behrman, Samuel Nathaniel Behrman, born in Worcester, Massachusetts in 1893, who wrote plays, comedies about a particular strain of upper-class Americans, comedies of manners, including The Second Man, Brief Moment, Lord Pengo, and No Time for Comedy. It's the birthday of Cole Porter, born in Peru, Indiana, 1891, learned to play the piano at the age of 8, went off to Yale University, where he composed football songs, and then wrote musicals, wrote both the words and the melody. His 1934 show, Anything Goes, considered by many to be his finest, including the songs I Get a Kick Out of You, Anything Goes, All Through the Night, and You're the Top. And it's the birthday of the Austrian novelist and pacifist Baroness Berta von Suttner, born in Prague, 1843, whose 1889 novel Die Waffen Nieder, Lay Down Your Arms, was hugely popular in Europe and had an impact there similar to what Uncle Tom's Cabin had in America. Here's a little poem by Emily Dickinson. I have no life but this. I have no life but this to lead it here, nor any death but lest dispelled from there, nor tie to earths to come, nor action new, except through this extent, the realm of you. And this blues lyric by an unknown writer. Keep on walking and walking, talking to myself. Yes, keep on walking and walking, talking to myself. Gal I loves with somebody else. I got the hard road blues walking on down the line. Got the hard road blues walking on down the line. Maybe someday my gal will change her mind. It's a hard, hard road when your baby throwed you down. Hard, hard road when your baby throwed you down. Gonna keep on walking from town to town. Gonna find my baby, don't think she can't be found. Gonna find my baby, don't think she can't be found. Gonna walk this hard road till my mustache touch the ground. Emily Dickinson's I Have No Life But This and the Hard Road Blues. That's the Writer's Almanac for Friday, June 9th, made possible by 21NorthMain.com, where book lovers find more than 10 million used, rare, and antiquarian books on the web at 21NorthMain.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Regional broadcasts of the Writer's Almanac are supported by Marquette Banks, your community bank, offering a broad range of financial services for your business and personal needs.
News headlines are coming up next. Then right after the news, we'll be back with political analysts Tom Horner and Sarah Stace, and your phone calls as well.
On the next All Things Considered, Jesse Jackson joins a Minneapolis rally for hotel workers in a contract dispute. That story plus all of the news on the next All Things Considered, weekdays at 3 on Minnesota Public Radio.
We have a fair sky, 80 degrees at KNRW FM 91.1 Minneapolis.